I remember listening to a Beethoven symphony because I was trying to be very open-minded. I had no interest in classical music at all. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to play bass, I better at least try and like classical music. And then I put on a Beethoven symphony, probably the Fifth Symphony. I was like, wow, this is also kind of rock and roll as well. What I really loved with Bernard Fields from the beginning, it felt like a kind of refuge for musicians who play that way in orchestra, who feel the same way as I kind of always felt in orchestra. This kind of movement and excitement and energy, and it's like a parallel universe of priorities. You know, if people want you to be more individual, they want you to move, they want you to come up with ideas. And the energy is very, sometimes it's like a youth orchestra, and I love that everyone's moving, everyone's risking everything in the concerts.
It's incredible.
And for me, that's what makes it feel as if I never had to grow up.
If bassist audition for the Berlin Film, what are you looking for in the sound there? Thank you for taking the time to do this. I know you are very busy, but now you have some free time and to still take the time for this. That's really cool. And yeah, especially since most people I do podcasts with, I know them. They're like good friends and we barely know each other. And you still were so friendly always when you responded to the emails and you were open to doing this.
Well,
so I really appreciate it.
Man, thanks for having me.
What I want to ask at the beginning is always interesting for me. How did you start with music, with bass, but overall with music? How did that happen, especially back in Australia?
When I was very young, I played violin, like Suzuki class, maybe a year or two.
Yeah.
And then we moved around a lot and I didn't have a violin teacher. And then in seventh grade, when I was 12, 13, my parents signed me up for violin again, and I did it. Yeah. I never practiced. I didn't really like violin, and it didn't like me either. But I was in this little violin class at lunchtimes, mm-hmm. and they had violin one, violin two, violin three. And the violin teacher put me and this other guy in the third violins. She said, we need the strongest players in third violins. And then I thought, look, we know what the situation is. Anyway, this guy in third violins was playing a bass line on his violin. Dun, 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 dun. I said, what's that? That's really cool. That's much better than Caterpillar, whatever we'd been playing. And yeah, he said, it's a bass line. Then he showed me one of the music rooms a couple doors away, his double bass and his bass guitar.
Ah, so he was besides violin.
He was playing this stuff. And I was like, wow, I want to play that. But I must have been about 15 by then. And so I spoke to my parents and they said, if you want to play bass guitar, you have to play double bass. So I said, okay, that's cool. I'll play both. I really wanted to play bass guitar at the beginning.
Yeah.
And be in rock bands. And
sorry that didn't work out for you.
And then I practiced over summer a lot on both instruments, reading magazines and books.
Right. You were not going, so your goal was not classical. It was more like...
No, I wanted to play jazz and rock.
Nice.
And I started off playing everything. So as soon as I had a bass, literally I was in a big band, a rock band, orchestra. It just happened immediately that I was playing in groups, different sorts. And I think that was the really motivating thing, that I was just from the beginning doing it with playing bass with other groups.
And it's a big advantage, you know. Zubin Mehta told this story once, why he learned the bass. Because he said, I want to play in an orchestra as an experience. And if I want to do it with the violin. I have to practice for 10 years or 20 years.
Yeah.
The bass, I can, after 2 years, 1 year, already play in the orchestras. And that's, you know, you can jump in so quickly. And but did you immediately also enjoy the orchestra, or was it still more like for the bands? And
I enjoyed everything. And I remember listening to a Beethoven symphony, because I was trying to be very open-minded. I had no interest in classical music at all. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to play bass, I better at least try and like classical music. And then I put on a Beethoven symphony, probably the Fifth Symphony. I thought, wow, this is also kind of rock and roll as well.
Yeah, can be, absolutely.
These driving eighth notes all the way through. And then I just loved all of it. Nice. And I didn't really see any separation between classical or rock or jazz. I just liked doing it. I was kind of incredibly naive.
Oh, but in a good way.
Yeah. In a good way. So that was great. And actually, I wanted to play jazz. And I auditioned when I was 16 for this kind of preliminary studies part of the Canberra School of Music. I don't know if I got into the jazz part or not, but I got into the classical, and they said, that's where you're going. And okay, so I did classical. I kind of was just sleepwalking through the whole thing, just happily playing whatever. Yeah.
Nice. So basically it was a bit of a coincidence also in the end that you ended up with classical. You could have also become a jazz.
Totally, yeah.
I mean, it worked out all right, I would say, you know.
Yeah, it worked out all right. But I think I would have just been as happy in jazz or rock, to be honest. I still love to play rock. I mean, it's still...
You still play bass guitar also?
Occasionally. I have a friend. He's in a band called Bonaparte.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic band. And our kids were at the same school. And one afternoon, his band played at the school kind of summer party. But the bass player wasn't around. So he said, would you jump in at the school party? I was like, oh my God. Yes.
Finally a good gig.
So I studied the songs that night and met him, and the next day, I think it was the best fun I've had with the bass for a very long time. It was incredible. It was so much fun. Yeah.
But with bass guitar.
I did it with double bass.
Really? Yeah. Nice.
Because Bonaparte have a really fantastic bass guitarist. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to fake being a bass guitarist, because I don't play bass guitar much anymore. Yeah.
But then you show what you do best in this case. Yeah.
Nice. That's great.
Yeah. Oh, but then, so you studied in this, was a pre-college program? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. That was great. That was great. We did lots of orchestras, string ensembles, lessons with one of Australia's foremost double bass players, Max McBride.
Nice.
So straight away, I had this incredible teacher from the beginning, and it was a kind of deep, full immersion. And actually, after a couple of years, it was by the end of school, I was like, oh my God, do I even really want to do this? It had just happened so quickly, and I nearly decided not to. I had a couple of days where I was thinking, well, actually, this was never my idea,
just happened.
But you know. But I'm very glad. Yeah.
Yeah, that's often, to many people that I talk, sometimes you just kind of ride a wave. And this is the same with me. I basically got motivated to play the bass, to really practice when I was like 13, 14, when I saw like YouTube videos of great bassists, actually. I hadn't planned to become a bassist at that point. I just thought, oh, wow, this is Botticini pieces. Oh, that's so cool. I want to be able to do that. And naturally, I thought at some point, well, why not try to do some competitions? Yeah. And then it was still in high school back at the time, and I just did it, and it worked. And now I'm happy.
it's nice if you just openly follow something as far as you can without even wondering what you're doing it for.
Yeah, or this, it has to be like, no, you just see where it leads. I think that often is this openness that can lead to the nicest places. So you went there, was it like parallel to high school?
Yeah.
And then for studying, you went to Sydney, right?
Then I went to Cambridge School of Music for the bachelor program for a couple of years. And I, after 2 years, I changed to Sydney.
Ah, okay.
Because I wanted to get out of Canberra. Nothing to do with the school or the teaching, which was fantastic. It was, I needed to be in a bigger city.
Yeah.
They had a part-time orchestra in Canberra, the Canberra Symphony. But there wasn't much else going on professionally there. So I moved to Sydney very impulsively. And then I started playing with Sydney Symphony a lot while I was there, which was
They're also in the Opera Building.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, wow. House,
yeah.
That's incredible.
So that was really great fun. I learned so much.
How's actually the hall? Like, I just know the building and how beautiful it is, but how is actually the hall?
Well, the hall until recently was inside famously mediocre.
Yeah. Did they change something, though? Or?
Yeah, they spent, I think during COVID, I don't know how long, a couple of years, completely doing the inside new again. The acoustics, they got fantastic guys working on it. And the sound now, the acoustic, I played there for the opening 2 years ago, Mahler 2 with the Sydney Symphony.
Oh, you jumped into
it. Yeah, nice. It was great. I was there on a holiday and they kindly let me join them for a program.
No, oh, Mahler 2, it's and for the bass section anyway. So
the acoustic is now really excellent.
Wow.
You can, fantastic. It's beautiful sound. You can really rely on what you're hearing on stage. Before, you kind of had to second guess what you were hearing. And you'd have this kind of unintended syncopation sometimes.
Yeah, oh, okay, okay.
Because the way it bounced back was odd. But now it's beautiful. It really encourages a more kind of chamber music aspect to the symphony playing.
I think that's also really quite fantastic in the Berlin Philharmonic. I mean, I've played there just a couple of times, but I felt it doesn't feel acoustically like a ginormous hall. You hear everything, you feel good, you feel resonant, but not overpowerful. It is one of, for me, I played chamber music there and also in orchestra, and it was one of the really, maybe the nicest, or at least one of the nicest halls to play in.
It's an incredible privilege to work there. It's just this hall. It's sometimes you just think, God, this is where I work. The acoustic is amazing, and just the way it looks and everything about it is wonderful. And I think a hall like that, where you have kind of limitless options as a musician, it's so good for an orchestra to have that.
Yes,
because I know
trains the orchestra.
Yeah, because you can. It will tolerate any dynamic, the softest, the loudest. You can rely on what you hear, so you can really just use chamber music skills while you're playing. Of course, there's a conductor, which helps as well, but you're not in a situation... you're not in a situation where you're relying on the visual cues of a conductor for vertical precision. You can rely on what you hear, which is most of the time. Yeah, I had to learn a lot when I came to Berlin, but I was always too early. I mean, sometimes, you know, German orchestras play quite, I don't know if you'd say it's behind the beat. I'm used to it now.
Yeah.
But there's space after the rhythmic cue. There's space, there's time for the orchestra to react to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, every orchestra has its own way of breathing.
I think there's some, like, if we look at also Dresden, Staatskapelle Dresden, or Gewandhaus Leipzig, or Vienna Philharmonic, I think Vienna Philharmonic tends to be very, Vienna in general, very far after the beat of the conductor. And that was, for me, such an interesting experience. Like a few months ago by now, I played the slow movement from the Mahler 10 symphony with a string orchestra arrangement. And the end is just a pitch, cello and bass. And the solo cello was a solo cellist from Dresden, from the Staatskapelle. And normally, I'm used to giving a cue. Either you go bam or you go bam. But he did bam.
Right.
But it was always together.
Yeah.
And I was like, How the hell is that? It worked, but how the hell did it work? I don't know.
I think it's also interesting that when a group spends enough time with each other, they recognize people's body language. Same with conductors. You spend enough time with a musician and you start to somehow just take it in without it being articulated. I don't know if they articulated on the fourth note is the pizzicato, but after a few years, you know,
feel it.
They just know. Yeah, it's interesting.
So back in Australia, you played a lot in the Sydney Symphony, but like just as a substitute, or
yeah, just whenever they needed, if they needed another bassist, I would.
And then
jump in.
How did you get the idea of going to Berlin of doing Karajan Academy?
Actually, this was one of the reasons which attracted me to move to Sydney. At the time, Wolfram Christ, the former principal violist of Berlin Philharmonic, he was artistic director. I had some kind of role at the Sydney Conservatorium. And he set up a scheme for, maybe it was just string players from the Sydney Conservatorium to go to the Karajan Academy. There was some kind of exchange or something like that.
Nice.
And I think it was open to all stringed instruments, and I auditioned for that.
But you auditioned in Sydney?
Yeah, in Sydney.
Very nice.
I'd auditioned for Karajan Academy before that and didn't get in. And then I was back in Australia, and yeah. I don't know if I was as calculating as thinking, I'll move to Sydney, that's my chance. It was just another
thing to do.
Yeah. And yeah, so it was through Wolfram Christ, through the Sydney Conservatorium, and then it was only a one-year scholarship then, and then I thought I'd probably go home. I hadn't thought much about what would happen.
But then quite a big orchestra career happened. I saw all the orchestras you played in. So, like, it was right afterwards you went to Copenhagen.
That's right, yeah.
To the Danish, what was it? The
Danish Radio Symphony, yeah.
As assistant principal or what was it?
Yeah.
Nice. And then afterwards, I did, of course, a bit of research. After a few months there, you already went to study more in Berlin.
Yeah, I think I got a bit cold in Copenhagen. And then, I mean, when I look back, I think, yeah, I think I just had kind of like winter blues or something.
Mm.
It was a really good orchestra, and Copenhagen's a beautiful city, but there's one day I just thought, why did I move even further north? I don't know. I'd only been away from Australia for a year and a bit. And then I also wanted to improve my playing.
Mm.
And I thought, rather than try and practice on top of a job, I'll just leave it, go back to Berlin.
But it was a very good position. So that's also quite a thing to do, to say, okay, I have a very good orchestra position, but I'm going to leave it to go study further.
Yeah, it was kind of impulsive, you know. I was 23, I think.
Ah, okay.
And 24, I can't remember. And just, I don't know, it was an impulsive decision. But also the thing is, if you make an impulsive decision like that, afterwards you have to really make sure that it pays off.
Yeah.
You know, so I practiced a lot. And
you started with Esko Leine.
Yeah, at the Karin Academy with Klaus Stoll.
Ah, nice.
And then Konzertexamen with Esko Leine.
And now he's your colleague in the orchestra.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
That must be. How does that feel? Your teacher now sitting next to you?
At the beginning, it was quite strange and intimidating for me. Nothing that Esko did, but in my head, just like, oh my God, how am I supposed to be principal with Esko next to me, this guy who taught me so much and who I just idolized. But he's so supportive, and also he knew me so well, so he could also read everything I was doing, and I knew him, and it was kind of, it's just been a fabulous thing. I mean, working with Esko has been just an absolute joy. But it took me some years to kind of feel comfortable being the principal
next to your
next to my old teacher. Yeah.
I can imagine. Well, I know I cannot. I could not imagine sitting next to Dorin Mark and giving him the cue. That would be interesting. The Konzertexamen, or what was it called?
Yeah.
And then during that, you started doing more auditions for the other orchestras in Berlin?
Then during that, I got some phone calls from Ensemble Modern, contemporary music group in Frankfurt. Yes. And I'd met a couple players from there in Melbourne. And I loved it. And I think I wanted a break from orchestras.
Mm. Ensemble Modern, you were the only...
Yeah, the only bass. It's, 23 people or something? Mm. I can't remember. And that was incredible. That was really amazing. Basically, 3 years working as a chamber musician with...
The top composers.
With the top composers who would conduct or talk about their own music.
Wow.
And just felt as close to, the living composers as possibly could. Yeah.
I mean, you now also do often premiere pieces.
I've been lucky enough to have, two premieres in the last few years.
Yeah, but two big premieres. I mean,
yeah.
Etwisch Concerto. I was supposed to play it once, actually. It should have been the Austrian premiere, but that was planned for 2020.
Right.
So
something happened then.
Yeah, I suppressed the memories because it didn't get rescheduled. I was so sad. Oh. I was really looking forward to it because also this idea of the Etwisch Concerto of having not just the solo bass but the two other basses that kind of are also solo basses.
Yeah.
How I know we're skipping a bit ahead, but since we're talking about contemporary music, how did that come to be? It was commissioned together with the Karajan Academy.
Yeah, so Pete Riegelbauer, who was a bass player in Berlin Philharmonic, was also the manager of the Karajan Academy, and he commissioned Peter Etwisch to write the concerto. And then we met, Peter and I. I mean, I've played with him before as a conductor, but then we met to talk about the piece, and I talked about solo tuning and scored a tour and all this kind of thing. And then I said to him, it'd be cool if the other two bassists in the orchestra also had stuff to do. I feel a little bit like embarrassed if I'm the soloist and the two bassists have nothing to do. He said, oh, okay, very quick. You see how quick his brain was? He just said, okay, good, we'll do scordatura. We'll have orchestral tuning half a step higher and you solo in the middle. And we'll have them out there. His brain was just instantly just on the spot in the canteen of the Philharmonie. Just
nice.
And it's incredible. And these colors and effects by the different tunings of the basses and the placement of them, yeah, it's really great. And working with contemporary, with living composers is just an invaluable insight.
And for the bass, so important, because if you want to establish the bass also more as a solo instrument, we need the big composers. I'm also working with a lot of them. I actually also met Ötvös once in Budapest.
Hmm.
He was listening to a concert of mine where I played the Stockhausen duo for trumpet and bass, and I had no idea who he was back then. I was very young, and now I'm really ashamed. I have no clue. I was just talking to him like to some random stranger.
I'm sure he was very friendly.
Yes, he was so nice. That's why I was so, just talking to him like. And then the trumpet player told me, you know who that is. I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, he was very kind. It was very sad in March when he died. Yeah.
From him, I would have liked the second concerto also. Yeah. Or the third. He was one of the greatest, I think, in the living. I mean, everyone appreciated him so much. But so that's why I'm very happy we have at least this one.
Yeah.
And the back then the leader of the academy, the other bassist, Riegelbauer, was mm-hmm. he is the one who initiated that.
Yeah.
Nice. So that's good to have a bassist in a position like that also.
Yeah.
And going back to the Ensemble Moderne, so 3 years you were working there, and then you became principal bass in Eddersby.
Yeah, that's right.
Why? How? What?
Well, my wife, who was the viola player in Ensemble Moderne then, we were going to have a baby, and Ensemble Moderne was incredibly busy. It was nonstop travel, and I'd been doing quite a lot with the Rundfunk Symphony Berlin. And we talked about maybe different options. And I enjoyed working with the Rundfunk Symphony, so I auditioned, and then we agreed we'd move to Berlin. It was a lot less work, and different.
The Radio Symphony Orchestras in Germany, they do offer nice contracts generally.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I played with them for a year and a half. And then I was doing a lot of Deutsche Symphony. And then I felt like changing again, so I auditioned for them and did that for a year and a half.
It also worked out. I mean, it needs to. I always find this so impressive when people say, then I played in this orchestra and then in that. Yeah, but you always need to win the audition first. So it's quite an achievement.
But I think I've almost never worked anywhere or had a job anywhere where I didn't have a kind of previous relationship.
Ah, so you would always play with them before. So.
Yeah, I mean, my first job in the Danish radio was really the only job that I got without having worked there a lot before. You still have to win the audition. But also, I think I was never really interested in applying for jobs in places where I didn't have any connection.
Yeah, of course.
So, I don't know, maybe I was afraid or something, but I really only auditioned for places after I'd already worked there a bit.
Well, but that, to be honest, it makes sense in a way. I think you also, on the one hand, you get to know the people, you get to know, is this an atmosphere I like, I would appreciate, or not? Also, do they appreciate me? Do they like working with me? Now I'm mainly doing chamber music and solo concertos, but when I think about who I play with in chamber music, sometimes I do with new constellations, but whenever I get to pick the people, I do appreciate if I can play with people that I know that I like to play with, not just musically, but also as human beings. And so if you go into an orchestra, you know this section, you know the people, you know that you can have a good time together, then I think that makes such a ginormous
difference.
Absolutely.
And I think, you see more and more with, as musicians get older, basically they play with their friends,
Yeah.
The great conductors and pianists, they're kind of, because playing music with your friends is one of the best things you can do.
And it is, I often think, sometimes I work a lot, like besides the teaching, then I play like this year, I think 80, 90 concerts, something like that. And so there is not much besides that. And then if I get to play with my friends, then at least I get to also, you know, play a nice concert, but spend time with friends, because besides all the gigs and the work, there would maybe not be time for that. Mm-hmm. So if you can kind of, that can be one of the most beautiful parts in my eyes of making music. If you can combine the job with a healthy, good social aspect as well, yeah, then it's the biggest luxury.
Kind of. Absolutely. Did a lot of karaoke last night. So I
really? What did you sing? What kind of songs?
Creep.
Yeah.
Nice. Dirty Old Town. I can't remember. There were so many songs. After a while, it kind of escalated. And
nice.
Yeah, it was good fun.
Oh, I can imagine. I need to do that. I used to do that a bit, but now... Well, I work too much, but I can do very nice and enjoyable things with work like this also. So that's a good part. Now, so in your case, so you went to Deutsche Sinfonieorchester also as principal bass, and then Berlin Phil principal bass came up.
Yeah.
How was the preparation for that? How was the whole approach for you for that?
I think I started practicing 6 months before.
Just with... focused on that one.
Yeah.
Wow.
To get my playing in shape.
What was the repertoire for that, actually?
I did a classical concerto.
Did the stuff
I Hall. Did Van Hall and Koussevitzky and solo excerpts. Mahler 1,
just
Haydn.
So.
Yeah.
Mahler, Haydn, and...
I can't remember what I actually played, but I prepared Pulcinella. Maybe we played Otello, actually, which is not the solo, but yeah. I mean, in a way, it's kind of a bit of a blur what I actually played on the day, but definitely Mahler 1 and Haydn.
But yeah. Not the Tutti excerpts.
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, but that's unique. And I don't think other orchestras have that.
No, I'm not sure I would have got the job if they had had that. I mean, I definitely... Playing these kind of orchestral excerpts are really tough. So
yes,
it was nice. Yeah.
Wow. And so 6 months. And what did you do? What was your like? I mean, there's the practicing the pieces, but you can do that after a week or two. But then there is the mental aspect also.
Yeah. I mean, I was doing a lot of practice Bach and studies.
Just to get in shape.
And then. A couple months before the audition, I think I started running it through for people. I must have done about 20 run-throughs, I think.
Wow. Okay.
Just constantly performing it for people.
Yeah, yeah. That makes a ginormous
just
difference.
Just putting it under pressure, you know, like they do with new cars. Just like smash them into walls and see if the airbags work, you know.
20 times though. Wow. That's...
Yeah, it was a lot.
Yeah. But that must be so useful. I can imagine.
By the end, you feel that, you know, when you've played something a lot of times, you feel just more distanced from it.
Yeah, I know it from like certain pieces. Like yesterday I played Bottesini Duo, for example, and I played it like 50 times or something. And at this point, okay, sometimes if I didn't play it for like half a year, then it's a bit refreshing, some of the spots. But if I have played it many times in the past months, then... I can be free. I can be so much more free. Yeah. And I can imagine for me, the orchestra editions, that's since, especially in the excerpts, it's not like you're playing the actual piece with everything that belongs to it. You're playing only such a, well, depending on the excerpt, smaller part. So I can imagine then that the playthroughs, the run-throughs, that must be so useful.
Absolutely, because an audition is a very unreal thing. I mean, it's much easier to play a concerto than audition because just this quick... quick changes you have to make from one accept or one style of music to another.
Yes.
And the psychological pressure that people are there to enjoy it on one hand, but they're also there to make a decision. And you're kind of, you can't escape that. And also generally when you're doing auditions, you tend to be younger.
Yes.
Not as much performing experience. So it's good to just force that.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. If the only time you play in public is when you audition for a big orchestra, then, I mean, there's really not much hope.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it was when I did the auditions for the teaching positions. You know, I could play in for a professor job in front of whatever, 10, 20 people, whoever was there, and that would be still more tense for me than playing a solo concert in front of 2,000 people.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because it's in the end, if people are there to just enjoy and have a good time, great, then I will enjoy and have a good time with them, but they're there to decide. And then also the fact that for good jobs, there will be many great people. And then the nerves start going crazy in the head. And then for me, it was always like, wow. Also the physical aspect, I would get so much more tense. And then I can imagine then just playing it through, of course. And
the psychological aspect is really such a big thing. And I thought about it a lot, and I needed the experience of playing it through many, many times to know what to do in emergencies.
Yeah.
So that you're prepared for any situation.
And how was it for you in the moment? I mean, it's it's difficult to say, but definitely Berlin Phil-based group is one of the, if not the strongest, well, at least, you know, the strongest is subjective in the end, but it is an insanely good bass group. And in the end, it worked out, the audition. Do you remember still some of the feelings of doing the audition? Or
When I look back, I felt like I was flying. I felt so happy to finally play it in the hall. And when I look back, and I'm above, when I look back in my mind's eye, I'm watching me. So I had this sense of objectivity and flying. Mm. It was really good fun. The last round with the excerpts, that's more scary because you know, you got these little things to play, and I didn't feel as flying in that round. The other two rounds, I look back and I think it all kind of, there were no major accidents and I felt good on stage.
Wow.
And I really do think it was just because of the endless
playthroughs.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. It's something I will tell my students from now on.
I mean, sometimes students, they say, well, yeah, what happened? I got nervous. It's like, well, that's really life. Like, You shouldn't be surprised you get nervous. Yeah. You should be preparing knowing you'll be nervous. It's crazy.
But you practice different when you know, okay, I might be nervous, and when you know how that feels.
Yeah.
Especially with the piece, right? Then you know, okay, at this spot, if I'm nervous, this will be the issue.
Yeah.
So I can prepare for that.
Yeah.
That was always, I think that's why the playthroughs are so important, or just playing pieces often in concerts. I think that you know, like, also for me, concerts or playthroughs, they are like, that's why I still like to play a lot of concerts now, even besides the teaching. They're like the best bullshit filter, kind of. Because there's one thing, what, you know, ideas that make sense when you talk about them and when you practice, but what works when it counts.
Absolutely. I mean, I always have alternative bowings, and now I don't really write bowings in. Because if I see the bowings, I feel a little bit locked into them.
Mm. But in the orchestra, you have to.
In the orchestra, you have to. Yeah. And I could be doing that better. But for my own solo stuff, I rarely write bowings. Because if I don't do the bowing, I feel like I've done a mistake.
Ah, yes, of course.
And I don't like that feeling that you've made a mistake for something you imposed upon yourself. Like, no one cares which bowing you do. And so if you feel this panic, like, oh my God, I've used two bows instead of one here. So I practice, and that you only learn that from the run-throughs, where it's going to be enough bow and where not. Inevitably, I use much more bow performing than in the practice room.
Nice. Good, though. A lot of people get tense and then they use less, and then they, you know. So that's, I think, that is a very, very good thing.
I mean, for me, one of the things I did learn about through all the years of kind of dealing with the psychological pressure is opening out helps me a lot. If I feel the, you know, and that inevitably means more bow for me, just keep things moving.
One thing that I want to talk to you about definitely is the playing style in Berlin Phil. We talked a bit about how you are with the conductor and stuff, but overall the orchestra, I mean, has a certain identity, a certain energy, especially live. And then there's also all the specific things about the bass section, the instruments they play, the staccato they play. But maybe before we come to the bass specific stuff about the orchestra, I mean, I heard so much, but to me, one of the things you said with the dynamics earlier, there are not many orchestras that go that extreme with piano and fortissimo, pianissimo and fortissimo. Was that something also for you that felt unique to that orchestra?
Absolutely. I remember when I did my first week there in the Karin Academy, and we're doing Bartok Concerto for Orchestra with Maris Jansons.
Nice start.
Oh, I was just terrified. But it all sounded fantastic, and it was like, okay, this is great. Then the concert came. All the pianos were softer and all the fortes were louder than in rehearsal and than anything I'd ever experienced before. It was terrifying, this spectrum. But what I really, beside all the details and sound and all that, for me, what I really loved with Berlin Phil from the beginning, it felt like a kind of refuge for musicians who play that way in orchestra, who feel the same way as I kind of always felt in orchestra. This kind of movement and excitement and energy, and it's like a parallel universe of priorities. You know, if people want you to be more individual, they want you to move, they want you to come up with ideas. And the energy is very, sometimes it's like a youth orchestra, and I love that everyone's moving, everyone's risking everything in the concerts.
That's incredible.
And for me, that's what makes it feel as if I never had to grow up. I mean, there are some aspects, of course, but in terms of the general spirit, it's still like playing a youth orchestra to me.
Wow. That sounds really fun, I have to say.
It's such fun. And when you think you're at the end of your power with some tremolo or something, and then you look around and there's a violist who'll just look at you, and you keep going. This kind of constant communication within the orchestra really keeps it alive.
It's the opposite of this negative cliche that we know of the orchestra musician who just plays their shift. But that's also what I feel when I hear the orchestra live, or when I watch the recordings. The energy that you give out, like that the whole orchestra gives in a performance, that is very unique. And coming to the bass section, it's also very special. I don't know like if that's there's other orchestras like that, but the size of the basses that you play in the orchestra, it's all like really ginormous five string basses.
Not all of them are huge. Mine is, but there are a few kind of modestly huge.
Modestly huge. But what's like the string length of the instruments? Also?
Oh, they vary. I mean, mine's 113 centimeters. Yeah.
I would consider that quite huge.
It is huge, but it's somehow also very playable. And it's...
I can imagine the resonance.
Yeah.
Must be, if it's a really good instrument. I always, when I played orchestra, I would mostly use a four string, often with the extension, which I know is... illegal in Germany, but I like it.
Although I read recently that was actually patented in Germany, a German guy, Dresden. I saw an old picture of Dresden Staatskapelle.
No.
Where every single bass player had an extension.
Wow.
I can't remember what year, long.
Must have been long, ago.
Yeah.
Now it's like the
devil. Which I found quite ironic, devil. You know, ironic, yeah.
But whenever I played five string, you know, I used to substitute often in orchestras as principal bass, and I always felt that the size with the five string, with the extra tension that just comes on, I mean, that tends to work so much better on the bigger resonant instruments. How was that for you, for your playing style? Because, well, for me, I found the five string basses. Just recently, I played a trout quintet in Spain, and I didn't want to fly with my bass for a trout quintet, so I got a bass there, and I got a five string, a Mariotto five string, actually quite nice instrument, not so huge, but really quite nice instrument. But it is a completely different style needed, even for an instrument like that, for those big ones especially. How was it for you to adjust? Did you have to adjust when you first went to Karajan Academy? How did you feel?
Yeah, very much. And they vary incredibly. I mean, and then sometimes the bridges on them are too flat, or, you know. But with my bass in particular, because of the huge string length, you can't really use a normal left hand technique. You have to be very flexible to move around the positions and find your way back to them. If you stay in one kind of traditional fifth position or something,
probably
you're just going to hurt yourself. So there's, and I think from that I learned a lot more kind of flexibility in the left hand, rotating, leaving positions, different things. In terms of sound, it's very different because of the tension and the size. They tolerate so much more abuse in a way. I mean, you can really dig in with all your weight and all your speed. And it doesn't say no, at least on my bass. You can really, its limits are so broad. You can play very soft, but also you can just give everything. I couldn't do that on a four string.
Yeah, of course.
That amount of bow, that amount of weight, it would just come out as noise.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think what's also part of the bass group is that these instruments require and tolerate so much energy. You know, because I know with a really good four string, you don't need much bow, and a lot of bow actually just doesn't work.
I think also it feels, for me, you know, I until recently also played cello in concerts, so for chamber music concerts, and then when I sometimes would play cello and then go to the bass, or the other way around in a concert, and for me the cello feels like a tiny little thing after having played the bass. But after playing on a big five string, going back to a normal solo four string would be kind of almost the same difference in feeling. It's a different instrument.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how, to me, that's very impressive, because when I played more orchestra, at some point I noticed it's not easy to stay in shape. Something I talked to some other bassists also about, but that would be very interesting, because you stay in shape. At least it seems like it. Mm. I mean, just 2 years ago, you premiered a bass concerto with the Berlin Phil. And how do you, what are your, are there some tricks? How do you manage to stay flexible enough also to be able to dig into the monster five string, but also make some fine, beautiful sounds in a four string bass?
I kind of work like a brass player in a way. So most of my practice is scales and exercises, some studies. And I don't practice that much every day, but I just try and do it every day. And when I have orchestra, I'll get there, and if I'm disciplined enough, I do a lot of Petrarchy exercises, basically.
Yeah.
And then scales, and if I have time, maybe a Bach suite, or I've only just started to enjoy doing studies.
Really?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Oh, I do any nonsense, like Nanny or...
The Nanny Caprices.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah, I had to, at Magna Kirchen competition, I had to play one by heart.
Yeah.
By memory. And they are, I don't know if I criticize them as a composition, but sometimes harmonically, they're a bit outside of what what we might expect.
It's like they're written by AI, really. I mean, there's yes. no kind of sense to them.
Yeah.
But in a way, that's why I enjoy them.
And technically, insane, quite really insanely demanding.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But also, because the notes are so bad, I don't mind if I play wrong notes.
Ah, okay.
Like,
okay.
I'm not going to perform Nanny Caprices. So if there's one, you know, so often there are notes, it's just like, why that note?
Yeah.
So I'll just do one that comes instead. I think, well, it doesn't matter. I'm doing this for me, not for Nanny. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I only like studies if they're easy enough to kind of sight read.
Ah, okay.
I don't really want to waste time
really properly
learning studies. You know, the ones that go through all the keys and everything like that. And I never had the patience to learn that.
But, you know, I think in the end, one of my main mottos is whatever works, works. And some people maybe need those studies. But if you do those and you do them half an hour a day and you stay in shape, it works.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I think variety is really the key. Because for years I only practiced cello music, basically.
Bach suites. And
yeah, sonatas, things like that. But then after a while, I would feel depressed if I was playing good music badly. So then I thought, I'll just do these studies. If I'm in good shape, I'll play Bach. But if I'm not in good shape, then I'll play Nanny. Because I don't mind if I play Nanny badly. You know? But Bach, I kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Also, I'm very pragmatic. Like, I'll do a Nanny thing. What do I want out of this? I want double stops, or I want strength, or I want this.
Yeah, of course, of course.
And I'm doing it for a reason.
That's the big thing. You practice with, okay, this is what I want to get out of it. This is what I need now. Well, what I also want to talk to you about, so you did the one premiere with the Karajan Academy of the Edvish. But now, 2 years ago, you premiered a bass concerto with the Berlin Phil.
Mm.
How was that? How did that happen? And how was the feeling of performing with your own orchestra?
Well, it happened because Gerald Barry, the composer, I think he spoke to Thomas Addis,
mm.
about the idea of writing a bass concerto. And Thomas Addis wrote to me, and then I kind of asked the orchestra, and the intendantin, Andrea Zichmann, was a big fan of Gerald's music. So she agreed to commission a bass concerto from him.
Wow.
And it kind of took a few years for things to get going.
There was of course.
Also COVID and all that as well. And it was a fantastic process working with Gerald. We were WhatsApping each other every day, videos, and I went to visit him in Dublin. It was a fantastic kind of collaboration almost. And an amazing insight also with Erdvesh. I don't think you really understand what notation is until you've worked with a composer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Until you've worked with a composer, you think that notation is everything there is.
No.
And then you work with Gerald, there was kind of very little information in terms of phrasing and dynamics and things like that.
He gave you the freedom to say what.
Yeah, but he expected me to do something with it. And I was like, gosh, I've turned into such an idiot, you know. He said, oh no. And then whatever he suggested or sang, I was like, of course.
Yeah.
Of course it wants to do that.
Absolutely, yeah.
He doesn't need to write crescendo here, short, short, longer, longer. It was just very natural stuff that you would do if you used your imagination. And that really was wonderful because he expects his musicians to bring their imagination to his
to use music. their own ideas. Also. Yeah. I have to say that for me was a big thing. I was lucky enough, my dad is a composer, so I very early on got to premiere pieces and see also what is his intention, and that I could also say, okay, this spot, if I do it like this instead of how you wrote it, it sounds much better and I think fits the character better. And then composers would be like, yeah, absolutely,
yeah,
do it.
Yeah.
And we often think like if a composer wrote something a certain way, it 100% has to be. And yeah. If we try to understand the idea, the message they might hopefully want to convey, they're absolutely fine with adapting that better for an instrument. Because of course, you as a bassist know more about how to use the bass perfectly than a composer would.
Well, we talked a lot about, I think he would write things in different ways. He said, just tell me if that works or not. And I said, well, this doesn't work like that. And we'll change it, no problem. Erdvesh as well. You know, he'd written some harmonics that were very awkward.
Yeah.
And he didn't want it to be awkward. He wanted it to sound good and natural. Of course, that was the main thing. He didn't want me fishing around all over the place because that wasn't the intention.
Yeah.
So he just changed the notes.
Nice.
You know. But of course, you can't do that after it's been printed and you don't ask the composer. You can't just change notes. But an insight into how flexible and how much a good composer actually wants it to work.
Absolutely.
But then, of course, your other part of the question, to play it with Berlin Phil was uniquely terrifying. Yeah. It's a very strange situation because you're at home, but also with musicians you admire so much.
Yeah.
It felt very supported, but at the same time, terrified. Yeah,
you want to also show to your colleagues, hey, I can
you don't want to let them down. You know, they've invested in you this time and money and opportunity, and you just want to live up to it. Yeah.
And I heard, unfortunately, I was just the week before I was actually in Berlin, but then I had other gigs and I couldn't be at the concerts. But I heard it was very big orchestra. So it was one of the orchestras where the bass would also be a bit amplified.
Yeah, I had to be amplified. The score is very big. And then since then, he's reduced it a little bit. But Gerald also found this struggle very appealing.
Mm.
So that's also an interesting, like he thinks very theatrically. He's written wonderful operas. And I said, oh no, I want to see the struggle of the instrument. I don't even care if I hear you or not, but just somehow the struggle of, you know, so he kind of thinks in a different way. You know?
But I think that makes the bass very interesting for contemporary music because it's, well, there's on the one hand a big universe of sounds to explore that many people don't know yet. So that's very fascinating. But also the physical and visual aspect that it can add, especially in contemporary music. Especially if you go outside of the beautiful, normal tonality, it has so much to offer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for anyone who's ever traveled through and gone through an airport or train station with a double bass and seen the looks in people's eyes, even before you play a note.
Yeah.
It's kind of an event, just this instrument being in the room with someone.
Absolutely. And for you, solo playing, did you always do that beside the orchestra? Did this come more over the last years? How was that for you as a priority besides playing in the orchestra?
I think it became more of a priority after I'd passed the trial in Berlin Philharmonic. I mean, I was always practicing solo stuff. I'd done the soloist's diploma, the Hans Eisler and all this stuff. But I was in no great pressure I felt no great pressure to go out and do it.
Yeah, you know? I mean, but in the orchestra world, you had reached one of the highest goals one can reach.
Yeah, I guess it had been such a busy few years going from job to job and having kids and all that stuff. And then I think I used to watch a lot of, I'd watch YouTube videos, and then I had this kind of guilty feeling if I didn't like how someone played. And I thought, well, you can't sit there and not, you know, just feel negative about someone's playing when you're just sitting there in your lounge room, not doing it yourself. I thought it has to be a fair playing field. If I'm going to really be part of this, I have to do my own. So I think I did a recital and just thought, I'll just record it and
this is the one in the chamber music hall in Berlin. Yeah. With Hindemith and Alan Mendelssohn. And of course, I watched it many times.
And, you know, because YouTube is amazing. And I just thought, I also want to be part of, you know, mostly I'm on YouTube to enjoy people's playing. But you know the feeling. Sometimes you see something, oh, what's that about? And I think, well, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Just be a sit there and not have my own recording on there and criticize someone else. So I put myself out there for criticism as well.
No, but I think to me this whole, I mean, social media has good aspects and a lot of negative aspects as well. But this part, that especially on an instrument like the bass, because I think, you know, it's not like in every major city you have a bass solo, concerto or recital every week.
No,
not at all. Like exactly. You have it once a year, or now once a year, now that many, many people come. But when I grew up in Vienna, we had like once a decade, maybe a bass recital or something. And without social media, I would not have known what is out there. And I would have not been able to experience that. And I would not have probably become a bassist, to be honest. Like my main motivation came from the online world.
Yeah.
So I think it is so useful also for people to then see, okay, how does the principal bass of Berlin Phil play? How does the principal bass of, I don't know, Vienna Phil play? How from New York and so on and so forth. So they can see also, well, this is a style I like. This is a person I might want to study with. And there we come to an interesting topic because you're also a teacher. And I wanted to ask you, of course, about that. I've been teaching a lot over the past years all over the world, but now in a fixed position in Würzburg for a year. And I always wonder, you know, how are people's approaches to that and what are their priorities also? So when you teach, like what are the things you would say that you really prioritize in bass playing or in music making overall?
I definitely, sound is always the biggest issue.
Yeah.
That is number one, actually, for me. Intonation, but that's more like, it's kind of, I don't spend as much time on intonation, say that note's out of tune, let's look at why or something. But sound is it kind of takes years until a good concept of sound is in someone's inner head. Because you can do every study in the world, but until you've got that sound
in your inner ear.
Yeah, exactly, that you want to replicate on the bass. It's interesting, it doesn't really happen.
I'm always surprised about that in so many countries or schools, because in the end, what do you hear? You hear the sound.
Yeah.
And I'm so often surprised when I see people who do all sorts of impressive things, but it just doesn't sound. And that's also for me, it is one of the main thing. If people come to me and if they don't already have a great sound, that's the first thing I will go on about. Because Heinrich Schiff said that's the main thing about playing, in his case, the cello.
Yeah.
It's the sound, and with the bass even more, I think, because we have such a unique sound. Actually, cello playing taught me that. I was a bit, I remember, and it was in my early 20s, was a bit frustrated because that cello could always be even more virtuosic, more forceful, more brilliant. And then I played cello again. And then I noticed, but the bass has this richness, this fullness, which no other string instrument has. So that was for me always. So what is kind of the color, like in the sound, that you would prioritize? What's for you the...
Well, I think, you know, talking about sound, there are two aspects. There's one that's just purely a practical good sound. It's open and you can hear it, you know, which is, you know, a big thing. But I think also sound has so much musical content.
Yes.
And in the end, every piece you play is a collection of sounds. It's not just a great sound that you just paint on every single note you play. So it's also about having a variety.
Absolutely.
But the bass line for me is rich and open.
Mm.
Very open. The more open it is, the better.
And how, just out of pure interest, if let's say you have a student that has a very narrow, very sound, what's your concept? How do you work with someone like that? What are like your main concepts?
Yeah, I think if it's sometimes it's not enough movement supporting it, or it's not, you know, this balance of contact point, weight and speed, finding that balance, because it's incredible. The cause of the sound being might actually be the cause for a great sound in combination with
other
the
things.
Right speed, you know, or the contact point just isn't right. It's incredible. You see someone making a bad sound in the upper register and they just need to go close to the bridge and use a bit more bow. I don't know. There are very often very practical solutions to this stuff. Just very often just not playing close enough to the bridge in the higher register is
that's one
the
of
main
the things I
problem.
Always annoy my students with. The bridge is your friend. I always say.
Yeah. But for me, I like to just see how much more you can get out.
Yeah.
The overturns, the openness, the width, the
openness
of sound.
Also, yeah.
And I love to almost like sitting by a fire, you know, kind of just play a note and just hear it crackle.
Mm.
Hear the changes of overturns, changes in just volume. Yeah.
And then adapting that to the different styles also. I think that is very, very interesting for me because obviously a forte in a Brahms, be it a sonata or even orchestra, compared to like some Mozart, in the end, this certain flexibility is also so fascinating. And to accomplish that also. So,
I think, yeah, like you have to be a little bit of a chameleon.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about sound, whilst I love big, fat, loud, juicy sound, when you're playing Bach Gamba Sonata, what I want there is a slightly thinner, more open, crystalline gamba sound. And
yeah.
So you have to have this repertoire of sounds so that for different music you can make different sounds, so you're not just good, I've got my big fat sound, I'm going to take it everywhere with me, you know. No, it's you know,
absolutely. One thing, this is a bit bass nerdy for all the non-bassists, but I the bassists, they're going to appreciate me asking this. If bassists audition for the Berlin Phil, what are you looking for in the sound there?
Well, I mean, talking about sound is like dancing about architecture or whatever it is, you know. It's got to be big.
Yeah.
It's got to be clear.
That's clear also.
Yeah. I mean, that's you know, it can't be crushed. When I first came to Berlin Phil for the Karajan Academy, I remember people talking about using too much pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to understand what that meant, that, you know, you kind of, probably just in the wrong contact point or too much weight, but that you're stopping the string from moving freely.
Mm.
I mean, my rule is just, can you see the string moving widely?
Yeah.
That's really important. And that's where the volume really comes from.
You know, that's a thing that I've noticed a lot. It's one thing using the weight flexibly, but then it's a matter of which fingers do you use. It's very bass nerdy. I'm sorry for all the non-basses, but that would be interesting for me to hear what you think about that. Because I have this is theory, but when I do it, it seems to change drastically how it sounds. And when I do it with my students as well, if you go more with the thumb or whatever finger is on top of the bow, in Viennese bow is the first, but you know, normally it's a thumb. If you use that as the main way to make the sound, then it tends to be more focused. If you use more the first and second finger from the side and less the pressure or weight from the top, then you get this more round sound. And when I look at your recordings, it's a lot with these fingers from the side. And when it's something I realized mainly also with the cello, some people, like from the cello, you don't really press so much from the top. It's most comes from contact from the side. And the people who don't have the hand like cracked to one side too much, who have a flexible bow grip on the cello, which again, yeah, much more comes from the side, they have the nicest, roundest sound often. Is that something also you experimented a bit with?
Yeah, I first started with a Viennese bow hold.
Ah, really?
Yeah, because my teacher, Matt McBride, had studied with Ludwig Streicher in Vienna.
Ah, yeah, I also started with the same. Actually, when you heard me in 2013 in the Janáček competition, I still played with the Streicher bow grip. Yeah.
And it has a lot of advantages. I mean, it still probably hurts there. I mean,
for me too.
After a while, and you develop this kind of weird macho pride in the size of your callus.
Yes.
And sometimes it hurts so much.
Yes.
But there are a lot of useful things, and also it really taught me to use the fingers.
Yes, and the flexibility.
Because very often I see in Germany people not using the fingers very much.
Yeah, if the hand is just stiff.
And just a lot of... And with Max, and through that Viennese thing, it was a lot about articulation with through here. Also the arm, but that you've got this...
For the fingertip feeling.
And it's amazing how many students I meet who have actually never thought of using the fingers.
Absolutely.
And wrist. But at the same time, you're not manipulating the movement of the bow with it, but it's another... It's like, you know, not having teeth trying to speak, you know.
It's for all the fine things.
For the fine things, yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, try and play trout quintet without having some kind of, you know, it's impossible.
I mean, if you look at the great cellists, the violinists, if you tell them, yeah, just don't use your fingers for articulation, they would be like, what the hell?
No, they're doing crazy stuff, yeah. But otherwise, and then I learned to use the thumb, have the thumb on top.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I contradict myself a lot because I tell the students like this, and then when I do it, it's great. But then when I'm actually playing, I don't know really what happens. I don't really think about it anymore. I try and keep the bow straight and near the in the right contact point. But you know, once you're performing, I'm not thinking about that anymore.
Yeah, of course.
And then it did shock me recently. A student said, "Oh yeah, I noticed your thumb is more there than." So. And I looked, oh God, it is. So it's like completely contradicted what I'm always teaching. But I do believe in being flexible with the bow hold anyway. And I will change it a lot depending on what I'm playing.
Yeah, me too,
just
actually.
Just instinctively, there are some things you just want a different weight somewhere, or you know.
In the end, I think that's what you said also at the beginning. It's you also training of the inner ear. If you know what you want, and if you give the body the flexibility, and if you build up, I call it always like the tool shed kind of. You need a certain amount of tools, and then when you play, you put the tools on the side and you play and you use them, but you don't work on the tools anymore. You only use them. So, because that's a big thing when there's so many people, and that's when they don't feel free, when you play like a concerto and you only think about the technique. How do I do? What do I do with my thumb while I play? No, when you play, it has to be in the end. It has to be music. But on the other hand, we need to learn the tools to use so we can make the music also.
Which I think is why it's also difficult when you're a student doing auditions, if you're in a major kind of phase of change.
Yeah.
And your body hasn't quite accepted it, like a new implant somewhere. It's still kind of like getting used to this new information, and that can be very tricky. It's very hard. I find it very hard to change things. sure things have changed over time, gradually.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think, right, I want to change this aspect, and it's impossible.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. But gradually, little things move a bit.
Even for you, with having established a certain style, you still continue to.
Oh yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really think I have a style. I'm still trying to get a better technique. I'm always working on
Fantastic.
The playing, and I think, I mean, that's a thing. I just still feel like I'm trying to learn how to play. Wow. Always thinking about this stuff all the time. Always trying to improve every aspect. I mean, that's the baseline.
Yeah,
I'm always trying to get better. I don't do 4 hours a day anymore because I have a life now, you know, like.
Yeah.
But when I'm working, that's what I'm trying to do. Yeah.
I think that is so important. I talked a lot to different musicians about that as well. And once they say, oh no, I got it now, I know how to do it now, I'm done, that's when it goes to hell. Like that's when you not only don't make progress anymore, but when you actually go many steps backwards. So I have always the feeling that most interesting players, they always continue working, they always try to become better. And for me, I have to say, since I started the regular teaching, that changed everything. I never learned so much.
Yeah.
For myself also. How was that similar also for you?
Absolutely. You know, it's been teaching a while now, and it's kind of, I think actually the teaching is what made me more enthusiastic about publicly performing solos.
Yeah.
Because then I was working on them all the time in the lessons, and I think I was afraid of playing publicly for a long time, solo really? Stuff. Yeah. And then teaching, where I was just kind of, you just find yourself playing all this in front of students all the time. You kind of, I don't know, just find your way into it. But having to think about it, absolutely. I mean, there's so much I did instinctively, and then you have to articulate what you mean.
Yeah.
And that forces you, and just by articulating what you mean, forces you to re-evaluate what you mean as well. And learning from the students, doing things in different ways, absolutely. And also, I'm always working on the basics. And I think that's definitely also through working with students.
Yeah.
You know, vibrato, intonation. Intonation is something I work on, you know, really a lot, because you just have to assume you're going to play out of tune.
For me also, intonation, I would say there's a spectrum. Let's say there's a D. And a D in D major is then at a completely different point than like in B minor. Like, let's say, yeah, like it could be here or here or here, and then finding the exact spot. And I have the feeling, especially if you play the bass function, a solo can be more flexible, depending, although it's great to really hit like a lower note at some point if the harmony demands it. But I have the feeling, as the bass function, we really need to understand where exactly to place the notes so that everything on top can build.
And this also comes back to sound.
Yeah.
Because the more information in your sound there is, the better you can tune. You know, if you're playing with a fluffy sound or a pressed sound, you're not getting the full spectrum of overtones, the information you need to be able to play in tune.
Yeah.
So you kind of... Also, the other aspect is, let's say there's a kind of F in D flat major or something, and you want it to have a warm color. You also want it to be in tune, slightly in a lower major third. And the concept of the intonation for that note will kind of match the color you have in mind.
Yes.
And so this integration, I'm more likely to play in tune if I have the color in mind that I want. Do you understand what I mean?
100%.
You know, I'm not going to want a bright sounding major third necessarily in a kind of, let's say it's a D flat major kind of adagio or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, I'm just imagining a completely fictional scenario, but I will want that F to be warm.
Yeah.
Possibly a nice wide vibrato with lots of bow speed. And once I've got the concept of what sound I want on that note, the intonation will follow.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That it's an integrated thing.
I have realized that now, especially strongly. I did a recording project with chamber music, so I played bass function. And recording this chamber music stuff, it was also with winds. The intonation is obviously a big topic. And I noticed whenever I get the emotional, because for me, sound color, and it's always a form of expression, and it's always emotional in a way. And whenever I would get the emotional part and all that belongs to it, the intonation was no issue. When I was just trying to play in tune with no emotion, with no means of expression, it would be so wrong.
Yeah.
But when I would make music with it, it was never a problem,
yeah.
Even in the trickiest places.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the beautiful thing about when you've got this kind of holistic... Sometimes you do have to separate things. Absolutely, you need to know the positions.
Yes, of course.
You know, you need to be able to... I like to tune my hand like a piano. I like to know as much as possible... the distances.
Yeah.
You've probably seen amazing how many people will get a seventh shift right, but a semitone.
Yeah.
And to have the flexibility to
do the tiny adjustments.
Tiny adjustments. You have to be able to do that. Otherwise, you won't be able to do all these things we're talking about. But at the same time, this kind of holistic concept of music, technique, intonation, sound, it's all one.
It's one thing.
One thing. Yeah.
Fortunately, just imagine, if we had to always think about everything separately. For me, it's like, yeah, in the end, it's all, the sound especially, a means of expression, a means to display some kind of emotion, some kind of story. And that can make it great or not. And you see that in an orchestra like the Berlin Phil, when they all go with the emotion, with the energy, with the expression, then, I mean, the technical things anyways are out of the question, they work.
Yeah. Talking about with teaching, and I think problem solving, it made my practice definitely a lot more effective.
Yeah.
When you spend a day trying to work out problems, what is it? And then when you go back and practice, you just waste much less time. I waste much less time now than I used to.
Oh, me too, definitely.
You know, and then if there's a phrase that's not working, I just look for the, you know, it's like when you have a smell in the fridge. You just look for the moldy lemon, Heidi. Ah, okay, that's the thing.
Yeah.
You're not going to buy a new fridge.
Yeah, of course.
You just look for the thing. You know what I mean?
You're able to find it quicker.
Oh, it's just, the something, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really what it's about. You just go quick, solve problems, build in the solution. That's it. Yeah, move on. You know, but it takes, of course, a long time to be able to do that. But now I think that's really been the benefit of teaching. Yeah.
Nice. So I have to say at this point, I think we're already going on for quite some time. So I do have to say once more, really thank you for doing this with me. I had a great time. It was really fascinating. Because especially in the bass world, Berlin Phil is a huge thing, but also then you're a professor and you have a lot of successful students, but also that's what interests me obviously a lot, is you do these solo performances and you do them really damn well, which I think is, especially as an orchestra musician, even bigger accomplishment. So talking to you, getting to know your ideas, also getting to know you, to me, was a really, really great experience. Seriously, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, it's a pleasure. Thank you.